The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Hamilton Kane is titled, In the Second Mountain, New York Times columnist David Brooks explores how to live morally. By any measure, David Brooks has lived a charmed life. He's gone from questioning young Republican to the protege of the iconic conservative journalist William F. Buckley Jr., to the right-leaning New York Times columnist even liberals love. Brooks' soothing, moderate tone is a staple of PBS. He speaks in perfect sentences. For over 40 years, he ascended what he calls the first mountain with ease and grace, summiting as an admired thought leader, marrying a college sweetheart, and raising three children in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. He's published a string of influential best-selling books. Barack Obama sought out his counsel. In the age of YouTube and Twitter, when any teenager can become an online celebrity, Brooks is the avatar of an endangered species, the public intellectual. But the public is not the private. In his new book, The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life, Brooks argues that his worldly success came at the expense of personal fulfillment, the desire for an otherworldly connection. Throughout his fifth decade, he felt a tremor inside, which erupted as his 27-year marriage ended. Alone in his apartment, he wandered through a wilderness of self-castigation until he found the map to start over, his gaze now fixed on the crest of a second mountain, the moral life, where the trophies passed out are less tangible and yet more real. One can't help reading The Second Mountain as a kind of atonement, some might say self-serving rationale, for his divorce and remarriage to his former research student Ann Snyder, 23 years his junior. But throughout The Second Mountain, Brooks offers trenchant insights into the journey of midlife, embracing philosophical uplift over partisan politics. How did you give yourself permission to write this book? As a follow-up to The Road to Character, which was published in 2015, I was planning to write a book about making commitments and executing them. I showed some pages to a few trusted readers who all agreed that I was holding back and that I should be honest by putting myself into the narrative, especially the difficult bits about my divorce. I hadn't ever really done such a thing before, but once I crossed the Rubicon of writing about myself, I was all in. I'm striving to live a better life, but as is often the case with writers, we're forced to work it out in public. The Second Mountain brims with erudition as you quote authors you've read, among them Tolstoy, Kierkegaard, Orwell, and Annie Dillard. How do we distill the book's lofty arguments into a street-level perspective path to happiness? My practical advice talks you through how to choose and execute commitments to vocation, spouse, community, and the like. There's a real skill to being kind. One blogger I mention in the book, Lydia Netzer, offers two excellent pieces of advice about marriage. The first is, feel free to go to bed mad. You're tired, get some sleep. Wake up the next morning and make pancakes. See if the fight looks so serious then. The second is to boast about your spouse's achievements in public. And as someone said to me during my research, marriage is a 50-year conversation. Hillary Clinton has said the same thing, that she and Bill Clinton began a conversation while students at Yale Law School in the early 1970s and have never stopped. Well, I would say that's a complicated marriage. The Second Mountain has some fancy Greek terms such as acedia. You write that acedia is the quieting of passion. And there's telos, a crisis defined by the fact that people in it don't know what their purpose is. Is it realistic to think we can break out of our spiritual isolation in the era of Instagram and internet selfies, which encourage performative emotion, the dopamine hit of instant gratification? We're addicted to screens. I have a friend who has instituted a strict no Wi-Fi policy for a couple of hours each day. He turns off his computer and phone. He leaves out paper and crowns for his kids. He's discovered that they engage in creative play more frequently. What about your first mountain, political punditry, trained you for this new calling of moral philosophy? Journalism means you're always on the road, talking to a wide array of people. Last year, I traveled to 42 states alone. I've heard that journalism attracts aloof people, perhaps more introverted, who find social context in their jobs. As a reporter, I come home each night with a story to tell. You write about reading A Bear Called Paddington at age 7 as your annunciation moment. What's an annunciation moment, and how do we recognize it? An annunciation moment, which plays off the story of the angel Gabriel's encounter with the Virgin Mary in the Gospels, is a moment that prefigures the rest of one's life. Often it happens to us when we're kids. As children, we live very intensely. I had my annunciation moment at the age of 7 when I read A Bear Called Paddington and realized I wanted to be a writer. We only recognize the annunciation later, perhaps years later. As I note in the second mountain, it's a useful exercise to make a list of 4 moments that you identify as peak moments, and then draw a line through them. You'll have a pretty good idea what your core is. Arguably, the second mountain's most stirring section is The Weavers, which details the creation and implementation of your Aspen Institute program, Weave, the Social Fabric Project. We travel around the country and meet people who are restoring social capital and healing lives, you write. These people are everywhere. We at Weave drop into a small town, and it is not a problem to find 35 people who completely fit the mold. What have the Weavers taught you about leadership and service? They've taught me about social courage. They show up for each other. They lead with vulnerability, and that fosters connection. You write with searing candor about your conversion to Christianity, or some hybrid of Judaism and Christianity, and identify pride as your cardinal sin. What practical steps did you take to renounce your pride? Well, first, being aware of it. Second, it was helpful to read spiritual writers such as C.S. Lewis. One doesn't have to be religious to appreciate Lewis. We all have innate spiritual responses. Those images of Notre Dame on fire, for instance, touch me deeply, as it did so many others. How has your second mountain impacted your children? Brooks has 2 sons and a daughter from his first marriage. This is an easy one. Children bring a level of commitment out of you that you didn't know you had. Biology is powerful. It reveals how deep love can be. You cite vocation and family as 2 of the 4 pillars that buttress the desired happy life. How does someone with such a prominent public platform balance those 2 things? Well, that's the great challenge, isn't it? Balancing vocation with parenting. My children are grown now, but when they were young, I made it a priority to be physically close to them. I write from home, that helped, but often I travel to report a story or to speak at a conference. Whenever I would receive an invitation, I'd weigh whether or not to attend by telling myself that these people were trying to hurt my kids, that my kids would suffer by my absence. I would ask myself, is it worth it, before deciding to accept or to decline. What percentage would you guess you accepted? You do what you have to do to make a living. My one rule was not to take trips on weekends. Inevitably, I would dread Mondays. I used to bang my head while on planes on Sunday afternoons and evenings, leaving behind a part of my heart. The great urbanist Jane Jacobs, author of The Death and Life of American Cities, looms large over your sense of community, and yet her understanding of community was radically different from yours, predicated on civic, secular values, while yours sees religion as a fundamental ingredient. How do you reconcile this tension? For the religious, it's all about love your neighbor, love your God, while for some, it's just love your neighbor. In the second mountain, I retell the famous story from Jacob's book about her neighborhood in Greenwich Village, how she was looking out her window onto Hudson Street in the late 1950s. She saw a struggle between a man and a girl and feared for the girl's safety. But as she watched, folks from the butcher shop and other businesses emerged to surround the man. It turned out it was nothing, just an altercation between a father and daughter. But this vignette is a strong example of how we automatically assume responsibility for the well-being of our neighbors. And by doing so, we're saying, this is my place. Our next article by Jonathan Borge is titled, Eat, Pray, Love author Elizabeth Gilbert has found love with her late partner's close friend. You'll want to open your heart up for this one. Elizabeth Gilbert is best known for writing stories that give you all the feels, such as Committed and Eat, Pray, Love, the bestseller that became a blockbuster film starring Julia Roberts. How does she do it? It just so happens her personal life is as rich as her narratives. On Monday, the 49-year-old author revealed that a year after losing her partner, Raya Elias, at 57, to pancreatic and liver cancer, she's officially found love again. At this time, her happiness is with one of Elias's closest friends, Simon MacArthur. The news came in a heartfelt Instagram post of the couple smiling wide together. It's a beautiful spring day in my corner of the world. Life is everywhere bursting forth with a sense of rebirth and renewal, and this seems like as good a moment as any to tell you that I am in love. Please meet my sweetheart, Mr. Simon MacArthur, she wrote. He's a photographer from the UK, a beautiful man who has been a friend of mine for years. In the caption, Gilbert goes on to explain that Elias and her new love lived together in London over 30 years ago, and they adored each other forever like siblings. This, as you can imagine, means the world to me. Later, she offered words of wisdom for anyone struggling to either find love again or to reconcile with the type of love they've found. If you see me walking around with a tall, handsome man on my arm, don't be buggin'. Just know that your girl is happy and following her heart. But also this, I will always share anything personal about my life if it could help someone else feel more normal about their life, she wrote. So, if you have lost a loved one to death and you thought you'd never love again, but you are feeling a pull of attraction towards someone new and you're not sure if that's okay, let me normalize it for you. Let me say, it's okay. She continues, your heart is a giant cathedral. Let it open. Let it love. Do not let your gorgeous loyalty to the deceased stop you from experiencing the marvels and terrors of your short, mortal, precious life. It's okay to live and to love. The message is a refreshing one amidst the turbulent news headlines we're all used to reading. If you once loved a man, and then you loved a woman, and then you loved a man, and you're wondering if that's okay, well, darling, let me normalize that for you. It's okay. Love who you love. It's all okay, and it's all impossible to control, and it's all an adventure that I would not miss. That's all I wanted to say. Onward, and I love you all, she ended her message. Gilbert has previously borrowed from her own relationships to inspire her own work. She met Jose Nunez, her second husband, after traveling from Italy and India to Bali, which inspired Eat, Pray, Love. Though she's gearing up to release City of Girls in June, fingers crossed she'll use this experience for yet another tale. Our next article by Brian Underwood is titled, Fran Drescher Thinks We Have Everything About Aging Wrong. For all the money they spend on original programming, the folks behind streaming services are realizing nostalgia sells. Classic shows like The Golden Girls and The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air are finding new audiences on these platforms, and as of last month, you can add The Nanny to that list. The sitcom, about a flashy girl from Flushing who becomes the caretaker to a wealthy Broadway producer's introverted children, is experiencing a resurrection of its own on HBO Max, and it delights the series' co-creator and star, Fran Drescher. The Nanny is an anomaly, Drescher tells Oprah Daily of the program, which originally aired on CBS from 93 to 99. It's like a modern-day Cinderella story, and Fran Fine had this immaturity that made kids love her as much as adults. And as much fun as it's been to rediscover Fran Fine, it's been even more fun to rediscover Fran Drescher. The 63-year-old actress, comedian, and writer is endearingly candid, with plenty to say about authenticity. If I'm not true to my word, who the hell am I? Consumerism. You have a lot of power with your purchase. And perseverance. The president of CBS once said to me, Fran, you're a Russell. You have the courage of Jane Russell, the comic timing of Rosalind Russell, and the tenacity of a Jack Russell. That tenacity may have even saved her life. After years of feeling like something wasn't quite right and being brushed off by 8 different doctors as simply perimenopausal, Drescher was diagnosed with gynecologic cancer. The experience inspired her to start a charity called Cancer Schmancer, which aims to empower women with knowledge about prevention and early detection of the disease. And now, as the new face of Laura Geller Beauty, a home shopping mainstay that recently announced it would exclusively use models over the age of 40 on air and in brand creative, Drescher wants to help shift the conversation around aging. This emphasis on youth is counterintuitive to the natural journeys of life on this planet, she says. It's just one of the many stupid things that we humans do. Westerners, I should say, because there are many Eastern cultures that have high regard and respect for the mature person. This is the towel of Drescher. The Nanny is hot right now. What makes that show so enduring? Well, all those kids from the 90s that were watching it are now grown-ups experiencing it in a whole new way. They're getting some of the adult humor and double entendre that they missed before. The costumes are amazing. The sexual tension between Fran and Mr. Sheffield is provocative and enjoyable. It still holds up. And since it's streaming and not syndication, it's really the first time I've even seen the original cut of the show without it being edited for commercials. Yours was one of the few portrayals of a Jewish woman on network TV, and you've said that some advertisers balked at that. How important was it for you to push back? Neil Simon always said, write about what you know. I took that very much to heart. I remember when Peter, Nanny co-creator Peter Mark Jacobson, and I got the green light to make a pilot, we were so excited. And even though we knew this was our big break and we weren't really in a position to argue the point, we told CBS that Fran Fine had to be Jewish. And I didn't know this at the time, but The Nanny featured the first openly Jewish character in a lead role on primetime since Molly Goldberg did in 1948. And we really went out on a limb because we spoke Yiddish on the show. We went to temple. We had a bris. We went to kibbutz. I dated a cantor. We did it all. And ironically, in spite of the network's concerns that maybe only New York and Miami would pick up on it, it was really the Sun Belt in the Midwest that gravitated to the show instantly and turned it into a hit. And maybe it wouldn't have been such a success if you hadn't stuck to your guns. Look, what I do is very rich in specificity and detail. I'm not Italian. I could play Italian. I did in Saturday Night Fever and have at other times in my career, but that's different because it's not week in and week out. I needed to play something very close to the rich and wonderful characters I grew up with. My mother, my grandmother, the people from my neighborhood in Queens. There's an Instagram account called @WhatFranWore that features classic Nanny looks. How involved were you in creating Fran Fine's style? Peter and I knew we wanted the character to be a clothes horse. We wanted her to look sexy without being slutty because she did take care of children after all. And we would have a 3-hour wardrobe session with the costume designer, try everything on, take pictures, and narrow it down. And an outfit would rarely be perfect straight off the rack. Most of the time, we made our own adjustments. It was a very collaborative art form. And we had that circular staircase to show off the clothes. We knew what we were doing, and the clothes still hold up. They don't look dated. You can be looking at an outfit from the 60s or the 90s. You had so many amazing guest stars, Bette Midler, Patti LaBelle, Cloris Leachman. Can you recall a memorable experience with any of them? I remember Elizabeth Taylor was very gracious. She sat on the couch in the living room and offered to take pictures with everyone. I remember Renee Taylor, the actress who played Fran Fine's mother, wanted one for her piano. And Liz's people said, you're welcome to it, but you have to pay for the retouching. It was going to be about $350, and she said, okay, I'll pay for the airbrushing, but whatever you give Liz, give me too. How did the partnership with Laura Geller Beauty come about? It's a funny story. I'm with my parents in Florida, surfing the TV channels, and I see something on QVC that says The Laura Geller Show. And I was completely drawn in. Before I had a chance to look into it as a customer, my manager called and said, "We have interest in you being the new Laura Geller girl." Well, I guess it was meant to be. That's the kind of stuff that happens in life, and I always respond because I know that the universe is pointing me in a direction. So I told them to send me some stuff because I have to believe what I'm saying. I have to really like the product. I asked a lot of questions. Does it have potentially toxic ingredients like lead in it? Do you test on animals? I talk to women about these things because women are the largest consumers on the planet. What we buy becomes not only our vote, but our protest. It's important we use our hard-earned dollars to make mindful decisions. How would you like to see the conversation around aging evolve? You can't overestimate what life experience brings to a person's aura. This needs to be prized, not admonished. I don't think that the maturing woman should be underestimated or marginalized. We have to embrace the new level of beauty, confidence, sensuality, and inner poise that comes with age. How do you want to reemerge from this last year? We have to start realizing that how we live equals how we feel. We must start looking at our lifestyle and stop looking for a magic pill that's going to take away the symptoms. What you are doing, what you are buying, what you are eating, all of your personal care items, everything you clean and garden with, it's either going to be in support of your body, your immune system, and the planet, or against it. Our next article by Annie Daly is titled, "This Kenyan Woman Landed Her Dream Job as a Safari Guide." Look, do you see that lion cub eating its prey with his mother way off in the distance behind those tall pieces of grass? My safari guide Charity asked me and my husband Raul. We're on a morning game drive in the Masai Mara National Reserve in Kenya, and Charity, the first ever female safari guide in the Mara, is pumped that we have stumbled upon the aftermath of a kill. I strain my eyes and peer through a pair of binoculars, but sadly, I don't see anything. Raul doesn't either. "Look again," Charity encourages us. "If you let your eyes adjust for a long enough time, you will see." And soon enough, we do. There, lying in the grass, is a lion and its young cub feasting on a freshly killed wildebeest whose blood is still lingering on both lions' whiskers. Charity expertly maneuvers the safari truck to bring us closer to the action, and before long we're inches away from the feast, watching in awe as the two lions go to town on their prey. "This is what you came for," Charity whispers as she quietly takes the keys out of the ignition so that we can sit in the utter stillness of the Mara. You would think, given Charity's laser-sharp eagle-eye vision and intrinsic animal intuition, that she grew up around the big five animals— lions, leopards, elephants, rhinos, and buffaloes. Or that she's been living in the Masai Mara for her entire life. But Charity Jamuti Chiriot, who is in her 30s but insists that a lady never reveals her age, grew up in a small village in the Rift Valley, Kenya, miles away from the bush life that is the Masai Mara. In fact, as a member of the Kalenjin tribe, she lived a very simple life in the farmland. She went to school, studied hard, and as the second oldest child in a family of eight, helped her parents raise her younger siblings. In other words, her life was far away from safari vehicles and kill sightings. But after she graduated from secondary school, Charity's life began to take a different turn. While most women in her village grew up to be nurses or school teachers, she knew from an early age that wasn't her passion. Though her mom desperately wanted her to stay home and follow the path of her peers, Charity felt a strong urge to be a flight attendant. "I'm a very strong believer in callings and the fact that God is above everything," she says. And so, when she felt her heart skip a little bit whenever she would read about planes or saw one fly above her village, she took that as a sign that she was meant to create a life around planes. "I would just feel something in me after I saw or read about one, and I would think, yes, this is what I want to do. I saw the planes as a calling that pulled me toward being a flight attendant, and I knew I had to follow that calling." Charity's mom, however, had different plans. She set Charity and her sister up with interviews for teachers' courses, but Charity bailed on the interview and instead applied for a flight attendant course. When she didn't get accepted, rather than surrendering to discouragement, she applied for a travel consultant course instead. She was accepted, and her dad paid for her tuition because he believed in doing what you love. But once she graduated, there was no job in sight, which brought on the guilt tripping from mom. Because my course didn't lead to a job, my mom had every reason to blame me. She would say to me, so-and-so just finished teacher's college, and so-and-so just finished a nursing course, and now they are employed by the government. But you're just sitting at home, and you have nothing to show for it. It was very difficult. A friend from Charity's Village who lived in Nairobi soon heard about her situation and invited her to come stay on her couch in the city. Charity got a waitressing job at a hotel, and from there, another friend introduced her to an employee at City Africa, which later became the travel company End Beyond. Charity applied for a job with the company, and after about 4 months of waiting and a mountain of paperwork, she got the gig, without even really knowing what the job actually entailed. All I wanted was a job in tourism to get me started, she explains. After looking for a job for quite a long time, if somebody gives you even a slight opportunity, you have to grab it. Turns out the job was to be a ranger guide in the Masai Mara, the first female guide there in history, back in 2007. They told me, "We want to see if we can employ female safari guides in Kenya. We've never done it before, and it's a very challenging job. You could be the first one." Charity had never even been to the bush before, let alone taken people through it, but she accepted, and the team sent her to a 6-month training course at Klein's Camp in the Serengeti in Tanzania. "That training was the hardest thing I've ever done, and most of the time I felt like I had made the wrong choice," Charity recalls. One day, for example, it was downpouring rain, and she and her group, 3 men and 2 women, had to cross Tanzania's rushing Grumeti River in the safari truck. "The river was overflowing, and I didn't even know how to swim," she says. "I was terrified." Eventually, Charity completed the course, an accomplishment she credits to an overall attitude shift. "We left at 5 a.m. every day, so I would wake up before that and look in the mirror and say, 'Charity, you can do it. If someone else has done it, you can do it too.' I was fighting a huge battle in my mind, but ultimately I told myself that I could do it, and I won." It's been about 13 years since that training, and Charity hasn't looked back. But that's not to say that she hasn't faced difficulties along the way. She is still one of only 3 female guides at Chichwetembo Camp and Bachelor Camp, her 2 headquarters at End Beyond, and there are fewer than 10 female guides in all of Kenya. And considering that the safari industry is still dominated by males, women are not always treated equally. Sometimes guests will ask to switch guides when they find out I'm a woman. One of my guests recently told me that he doesn't like ladies because we are stupid like wildebeests. I felt sad for his wife and asked my manager to switch guests. Then I was so happy because I took my new guests on a fantastic game drive, and we saw animals my original guests didn't get to see. I thought to myself, yes. Other male safari guides in the Mara don't always treat her equally either. When I first started, it was still all men in the Mara, and they kept doubting me, asking, "Are you sure you know what you're getting yourself into?" she says. One day, a couple of years ago, a senior male guide started chasing her car with his, just to get a reaction out of her. I pulled over to the side to let him go, and I realized that some people were just not very happy to see me intruding on their space. But he just gave me more reasons to believe in myself. In the end, she's certainly proven the doubters wrong. Even her mom is a believer now, thanks in part to a trip to the Mara to see her daughter in action. Charity's father passed away in 2009, so she also sends her mom money now to help support her siblings. But most importantly, she's proven herself right. From the beginning, Charity always knew that she must follow her calling, even though her dream went against the typical role of women in her village. And even though her calling didn't turn out to be a flight attendant, she did land in the tourism industry, where she drives her guests to and from bush jumper planes every day. But most importantly, she simply loves her job. I think everybody is created with at least a little bit of passion in themselves, she reflects. My advice is to keep listening to that one thing deep inside you that makes your heart tick, and then follow that and don't give up. Our next article by Emma Dibben is titled, "Does the person in the middle seat of a plane get both armrests? Twitter is divided." We've all been there. You're super excited for your trip, until you get to the airport and realize you forgot to check in online, or you're on one of those stingy basic economy fares that don't let you pick a seat. You know what this means. The middle seat is yours. Here's the thing. No one likes the middle seat. It doesn't come with gorgeous views or the relative privacy of a window seat, nor the legroom and easy bathroom access of the aisle. Plus, being crammed between two people in coach is never fun. According to one school of thought, the only upside to sitting in the middle is that you get two armrests to yourself, while the people in the window and aisle seats use the single armrest near the window and aisle, respectively. But do you? It turns out this is a pretty contentious issue, as evidenced by a recent Twitter poll. Does the person sitting in the middle seat on airplane get both armrests, asked sports journalist Rich Eisen in the poll, which ended up receiving more than 100,000 votes. The final results? A majority, 53%, of people responded no way, while 47% said definitely. So who does get the extra armrest, according to the 53%? It's not entirely clear from the poll, but Mashable suggests that the alternative option is that each person should use the armrest to their left, and the person in the window seat will get one extra armrest next to the wall. This is specific to planes where three people are sitting in a row on the right side. Twitter users had a lot of opinions on the result, and plenty of people argued strongly in favor of the middle seat gets both armrests option. When you're on an airplane, there's a thing called plane etiquette, and it goes like this. Window gets an armrest and a wall. Middle gets two armrests. Aisle gets an armrest and a little bit of extra legroom. We're not animals, we live in a society, Sean Patton wrote, attributing this quote to comedian Jim Jeffries, who was way ahead of this plane etiquette debate and addressed it in a stand-up set over 3 years ago. Those saying no way, reconsider. I hardly ever sit in the middle, and I always yield my armrest to the middle seat passenger. It is a rule of travel, argued a user by the name Crazy Diamond. They totally should, argued another respondent, Ryan Mays. They're the ones stuck between two people, and that should be their added benefit. And if you're out here wondering why we can't just share the armrest like civilized humans, you're not alone. User at Quinoy advocated for a middle ground. I always try to equitably share armrests with one person using the front and one the back of it. If my terms are unsatisfactory, prepare for elbow wars. So all in all, if you're stuck in the middle seat and searching for a silver lining, these results are kind of a mixed bag. But let's not forget that armrests have been scientifically found to be some of the dirtiest, most germ-packed areas on a plane. So having two to yourself is not necessarily the perk it appears to be. Honestly, just pick your seat in advance if at all possible and bring antibacterial wipes. Happy travels! Our next article by Amy Heckel is titled, Powerlifting Changed My Relationship with My Body. I take a deep breath as I look around the warm-up area at the Mr. Olympia Pro Powerlifting competition in Las Vegas. Well, actually, I look up, because everyone around is about a foot taller than me. I can almost hear the Sesame Street song teasing, one of these things is not like the other one. I'm the smallest powerlifting competitor by 40 pounds. I've never been an athlete, I used to hide in the locker room during gym class, and I've never competed in a sport before. I'm a 40-year-old mom and legally blind book nerd. I clearly don't fit in, and I've never felt more at home. On the surface, it doesn't make sense that I'm competing for a world record in powerlifting, a strength sport that measures your maximum single lift of the squat, bench press, and deadlift. But below the surface, this is exactly what I've needed all my life to heal my past, escape the social constructs that have haunted me, and refind my true self. Holy heck, I am terrified. Deep breath. I remind myself why I am chasing that fear. Heavy weight has given me myself back, my power. Women are constantly told to shrink, take up less space, diet, be quiet, be smaller, smaller, smaller. Cut it off, suck it out, don't get bulky, be a lady, cross your legs, shh. Lift tone if you must, but don't get too big. Powerlifting defies this. It demands you take up space and grow. It measures your strength, not your weight or fat percentage. It encourages women to be bigger, and not just physically. The barbell doesn't care how sexy you are, or if you have stinky armpits, scars, or untamed hair. Check, check, and check. You can either lift the weight or you can't. And you can't get stronger without confronting discomfort and failure upon failure. So many lessons, and they all extend beyond the platform. Everywhere I turn, other women echo this. I started powerlifting during a dark period in my life, says Christiana Lanati, who's at the Olympia to pursue bench press records. I wasn't sure why I needed it so bad or what I was trying to prove, but ultimately it didn't matter. Lifting gave me hope and eased my suicidal thoughts. It became my therapy. Leonati's not just in Vegas for herself. She's also raising money for Pull Your Heart Out, a nonprofit she founded to pay for other women's gym memberships and competition fees. The money raised today will sponsor two young women in a family of 8 kids who just lost their mother in a motorcycle accident. Lifting, to many of us, is our grounding. It saves us from depression, anger, and complacency. The iron is a reason to live and a reason to keep going, Leonati says. The barbell is healing me too. I have suffered multiple abdominal traumas and even clinically died due to blood loss, but I have fought my way back to life and to health. I am also a survivor of domestic violence. As a naturally small woman, my size has been used as a weapon against me, to shrink me and terrorize me. I am the weapon now, I remind myself as I tighten my belt. Today, I take it all back on the platform. I will not be small anymore. We will not be small anymore. I am a symbol of a growing trend of women sick of shrinking. Powerlifting among women is surging. USA Powerlifting has seen a boom in female membership from 21% to 35% between 2011 and 2018, and there are increasingly more powerlifting training programs specifically for women, like Colorado-based Corvus Strength Company. Worldwide, the increase is even bigger. Powerlifting meets have nearly doubled in participation between 2014 and 2018, from about 59,000 competitive lifters to more than 101,000, according to the Open Powerlifting Project, which tracks global powerlifting data. In that time, the number of women competing in powerlifting has nearly doubled. Men's rate of growth hasn't kept up. Needless to say, the gap between men and women is quickly closing. In 2014, only about a quarter of competitive powerlifters were women. Today, 1/3 are. There's a growing shift in society's perception of what it means to be a woman, and the sudden surge of powerlifting is a natural expression of this change. You can see the evolution on social media in things like the Instagram page you.look.like.a.man, which makes sarcastic memes out of things people say to female athletes. If you're going to lift that much weight, you need to smile while you do it. Aren't you afraid of getting bigger? Just don't get to be too big. Women are now speaking up about things they used to hide in shame and seeking out things that used to be for men, quote unquote, and then rising to the top of those things. As of fall 2019, the top 5 best powerlifters, according to the Wilks calculator, a coefficient used to measure powerlifters' strength despite size, was not some giant Russian man with a power belly. They were all women. Stacey Bama Burr hit number 1 in March of 2019. When she began powerlifting in 2014, she says it felt like a different era. Back then, she says she was kicked out of a gym for being too loud. People laughed at me and picked on me because I was a girl and I was too raw and too aggressive, she says. Today, people pay Burr to visit gyms around the country to be her too much self. She is a motivational speaker, a coach, and runs a podcast, The Champion Mindset. Behind the stage at the Olympia, I'm on my last warm-up set. I catch Leonati's eye, and I remember what she said a few nights ago when I told her I felt like an imposter. Outcast is just another word for trailblazer. Whenever you feel like you don't fit in, that's an honor, because it means you are doing something different. Burr calls it a new era of femininity. It's whatever roles we want to create, she says. Femininity now is so raw and powerful and everything and nothing all at the same time. What is feminine? I don't think it exists anymore. This has not dulled down what it means to be a woman. It has expanded it. I hear the announcer call my name and the world goes blank. It's just me and the barbell. For a moment, my initial motivation runs through my veins, the desire to unwrite my past and feel free of society's expectations. But that dissolves and leaves me only with this moment. Hands on the cold bar, inhale and brace, three white lights. I get that world record for the deadlift in my age and weight class, but I also get something much more. The satisfying weight in my hands drains all thoughts from my mind, and with them all past and all future. It's like the most bizarre, shaking, sweaty, chalk-covered meditation. I feel my power, and it feels like me. No words, no labels, just me. My own undefinition of femininity. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is, I discovered my rescue dog was a rare breed I didn't know existed. During an interview with Priyanka Chopra Jonas on Super Soul Conversations, Oprah remarked that having a dog changes the feel of a house. 7 months ago, I might not have understood that. But now my home is ruled by a 17-pound auburn-colored burst of energy we call Corey, and I know exactly what she means. Corey is definitely a dog, or so the New Jersey-based rescue agency claimed when my family adopted her back in November. Sometimes, though, I'm not entirely convinced she's a canine. She has ears shaped like Baby Yoda's, the mournful eyes of a cursed prince trapped in an animal's body, and a nub where there should be a tail. If you told me she was an alien or an elf, I'd believe you. And so I turned to Embark, a dog DNA test that Oprah named one of her favorite things in 2018, to classify this creature that had conquered my beanbag and transformed my life. The company scans for over 350 breeds and claims its results are 95% to 99% accurate. The process itself reminded me of the first time I put in contact lenses. You want me to do what? Put my finger in my eye? That's how I felt while reading the clearly worded instructions that came in the blue Embark box, which told us to swab the area under Corey's lip for at least 30 seconds. I love my dog, but no, my finger won't be going near her teeth. Naturally, I put my sister, who is much tougher than I am, in charge of the task. After hitting the saliva quotient, we had to twist the cotton swab into a fluid sample for transport, send it back in a prepackaged envelope, and wait. While waiting, I drew upon a childhood obsession, a dog breed encyclopedia, to come up with my best guesses as to Corey's genetic makeup. I decided she had the ears of a Basenji, a regal African breed, the peppy outlook of a rat terrier, and the dignified stature of Doberman Pinscher. The adoption paperwork also contained a clue. It classified Corey as a feist dog, or a category of small hunting dogs bred in the South. Even our vet weighed in. Her money was on Basenji. Unable to live with the mystery, I obsessively combed through subreddits like Doggy DNA and ID My Dog, in which other users guess breeds based solely on photographs. But the Embark test had surprises I never could have predicted. In the spring, 6 weeks after sending in the sample, I received an email from Embark saying the test results were in. On the landing page, a video popped up playing cheery music. Turns out Corey is predominantly a mountain cur, a combination of words I had never encountered before that moment. Mountain curs, I learned, were originally bred in the mountains of Kentucky, Virginia, and Tennessee, and were considered a necessity for settlers in the region for their protection skills. The American Kennel Club describes mountain curs as being courageous hunters and extremely intelligent. They're also expert squirrel hunters, but I didn't need a test to tell me that. I'd seen Corey in action. Once ubiquitous among the region's frontiersmen and homesteaders, these devoted working dogs are now considered a rare breed. Today, they're predominantly found in the South, which explains why I'd never met one in New Jersey. Significantly smaller than the average mountain cur, Corey's stature is explained by her also being 19.8% rat terrier, 10.8% Beagle, 9.2% Boston Terrier, and 11.2% Super Mutt, composed of Toy Fox Terrier, American Eskimo Dog, and American Water Spaniel. I now had an explanation for Corey's ears and hound-like relentlessness, but how much did these results matter? According to vets, these DNA tests are especially important when it comes to rescue dogs, whose pasts are often unknown. The tests are very beneficial. It gives us a wealth of knowledge about breeds and genetic predispositions, Dr. Terrence Ferguson, star of the Nat Geo show Critter Fixers Country Vets, tells Oprah Daily. Prior to the home kits, DNA testing was prohibitively expensive. Embark costs $129. Now many pet owners come into veterinary visits prepared with information, though Dr. Ferguson cautions that the test results should be deciphered alongside a professional. When it comes to training, New Jersey-based dog trainer Lisa Hess says breed test results can make a significant difference in her approach. Even though there are certain traits that all dogs have, there are certain traits that are inherent to that breed, she says. For example, hounds with a strong prey drive require activities that involve chasing. Often, Hess will adjust training strategies after the DNA test. Every dog is an individual. As a trainer, you need to figure out how that dog learns, she says. DNA is a bit of that puzzle. Ultimately, vets and dog trainers say that the benefits of testing are largely emotional, and I was emotional after opening up the test. Often, while looking into Corey's penetrating eyes, I wondered about the years before she came into our lives. Why does she bark relentlessly at the sight of a broom? Where did she get the scar under her eye? And most pressingly, who could have let this creature out of their sight? Prior to the Embark test, I came up with an elaborate Dickinsonian backstory to answer these questions. In my head, she was the runt of the litter and abandoned to fend for herself. She befriended a pack of dogs. They strutted around the countryside of North Carolina to the West Side Story soundtrack. The results of the Embark test give me a kind of closure. Writer Kelly Conaboy, the author of the moving and hilarious memoir, The Particulars of Peter, a must-read for dog owners and dog lovers alike, had a similar reaction to getting her dog Peter's results. With a rescue, everything about what makes up their body is a mystery. It's nice to imagine the results as a little history of Peter coming to be and who his parents might have been. Any solid knowledge helps when you're so in love with these little creatures who are mysteries, she says. Ultimately, knowledge of Corey's breed hasn't changed my relationship with her. She's still the curious dog I fell in love with at the adoption fair, always searching for cheese, socks, or affection. But now, looking at the family tree on Embark's website, which goes back generations, I can slot my family at the very end, and that makes all the difference. Our next article by Gina Way is titled, Don't Judge Me Because I Get Botox. How many times have you heard or thought or uttered this question? What has she had done? At this point, the phrase is so pervasive as it relates to a woman's looks, it's become part of our vernacular. Several times a week, I find myself Googling a celebrity's name followed by age or neck lift. I frequently have this very conversation with my girlfriends, or more accurately, my women friends of a certain age. Why do we care so much? With each passing year, I'm reminded of Betty Davis's famous quote about getting up there, "Old age ain't for sissies." How right you were, Bet. When I turned 50, something shifted. Everyone suddenly seemed so much younger than me. That newscaster on TV, practically pubescent. The kid fronting my new favorite band? He could be my son. And worst of all, that cashier at Whole Foods just called me ma'am. I had become middle-aged, and I wasn't sure how to process that. Some women feel defiant. Justine Bateman, famous for playing Mallory on Family Ties back in the 80s, is one of them. She wrote a book, Face, One Square Foot of Skin, about women, aging, and why she'll never get plastic surgery of any kind or a cosmetic procedure. It captured my attention as I was sitting in my dermatologist's office waiting to get Botox. I'm about the same age as 50-something Bateman, and I am her total flip side. Bateman's philosophy is a call to arms. There's nothing wrong with your older face, and it doesn't need fixing. So why is there such negativity, hatred, horror even, directed at aging female faces? The answer, according to Face, is that we live in a sexist and ageist society in which media and beauty companies hammer us with anti-aging BS. Bateman also writes about the infuriating double standard of how men don't experience these same pressures and have innate confidence as they age. There's so much judgment aimed at older women, while the weathered visages of leathery old geezers like Clint Eastwood, Sam Elliott, Keith Richards, and every one of the Rolling Stones are not only okay, they're considered sexy. Preach, Justine. Face is comprised of 47 fictional vignettes that seek to explore this issue. Like Bateman herself, the women in these snapshots wear their cosmetically untouched faces like wrinkled badges of honor. Very cool. Almost all of them consider that getting something done, even using pricey anti-aging creams, is an anti-feminist betrayal. One protagonist ends a relationship with a friend who had a facelift. Not cool. Because on top of all the important questions that Bateman poses, I'd add another. When it comes to our personal decisions about injections, why do we judge each other so much? In turning on each other, aren't we submitting to the most insidious part of the cultural convention that Bateman rails against in her book? We can act like mean girls writ large, and famous people are fair game for all kinds of criticism, even vitriol. When Jennifer Lopez recently said she'd never had Botox or cosmetic surgery, social media trolls went on the attack, insisting the secret to the star's glowing skin had to be cosmetic enhancement. Is it so unbelievable that she's just blessed with really good DNA and an extensive skincare regimen? And ultimately, and more importantly, who cares? As Joan Rivers would say, oh, grow up. While I respect a woman's choice to not have anything done and applaud those who love the lines on their lived-in faces, the reality for many women is far more complex. Take me, for instance. I'm a beauty writer and editor in a youth-centric, selfie-obsessed media universe where millennial editors write earnest first-person essays about how they're aging when they turn 30. It gets to you. But that's not why I get Botox and filler. Neither is it insecurity, self-hatred, people-pleasing, especially men, age shame, or wanting to look young. I'm old enough to know that cosmetic tweaks don't impart self-worth, but they sure make me feel better when I look in the mirror. These little modifications improve my mood and outlook. Does that mean on some level I'm succumbing to a definition of beauty defined by centuries of sexism? That's Bateman's argument, but not mine. During COVID lockdown, I was stuck in my apartment alone for months and got pretty depressed. I considered going to therapy or moving back to LA. It was bad. One day I decided to finally give my gray roots a desperately needed touch-up with DIY dye. When I was done, voila, a whole new me. I hadn't realized just how transformative fresh hair color could be. I felt more like myself, rejuvenated, pulled together, game on. I had the same feeling when I was safely able to have my Sharpay-like forehead smoothed with Botox. This is the therapeutic power of beauty for me. We all want to feel confident and strong, to be our best selves. If coloring your hair helps you do that, great. If it's getting some Botox or filler, also great. Dermatologic touch-ups and my over-the-top skincare regimen are proactive ways of caring for myself. For me, it's empowering. It's taken me all these years to finally accept myself, to like how I look, most days, and to come into my own power. Botox and filler didn't do that. I did that. And just because I have some work done doesn't make me superficial or less authentic. Reading the stories in Bateman's book, I felt like a vegan was giving me the side eye as I ate a bacon cheeseburger. Let me enjoy my burger. I hope you enjoy your salad. No big deal. In yoga class, you hear the expression, stay on your mat, which means you should try not to compare your practice to others. Basically, you do you. It's a good life lesson. Not everyone's goals or journey will be the same. Life can get challenging as we get older, especially as women. Society judges us. Men judge us. Let's not judge each other. I'm fully here for Bateman's viewpoint, and I think she's a badass woman who doesn't need any damn fixing. I also think I'm pretty badass, even though I get cosmetic touch-ups and revel in a beauty routine that could easily take most of a Law & Order SVU episode. So thank you, Justine, for starting this important discussion. Let's talk about it, ladies, about aging and empowerment without judgment. There's room for all of us in this conversation. Our last selection for this week is from Oprah herself. She reveals what it really takes to come into your own. It's often used as a compliment, a way to express that someone has been successful, but to me that definition of success is all about alignment. It's what Gary Zukav calls when the personality comes to serve the energy of the soul, where you are in alignment with what you really came to do on earth, and using your personality to serve that. That's when you come alive. That can look different for every single person because coming into your own, that alignment is different from his own or her own or my own. But the common denominator is that it's all about alignment. And I learned at a very young age that if things are to move forward in my life, I was the one who had to take responsibility for what Mary Oliver calls our one wild and precious life and not be defined by other people's idea of who I should be, even if the other people were my family. My story isn't unlike Ashley C. Ford's. In her new memoir, Somebody's Daughter, she talks about her challenging childhood growing up a poor black girl. Her mother had mental health issues, and her father was incarcerated and not present in her life, and she survived an abusive relationship, yet she was able to put the pieces together to overcome and come into her own. I hope you remember that there is no timeline for coming into your own. For some people, it happens in their early 20s, and for others, they're like 45, 50, still trying to figure it out. And it's never too late because everyone's journey is different. And this is what I do know, that you don't become what you want, you become what you believe. So listen to your inner self, be kind, and know for sure that you are here on this earth because you have a contribution to make. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.